From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Good Tuesday afternoon to you. I'm Sarah Perry, your host on this, the 9th of June, 2020. On today's edition of Washington Watch, in the wake of the burial of George Floyd, who died at the hands of Minneapolis police, calls are increasing for defunding and disbanding police departments nationwide. Officials in Minneapolis, Los Angeles, Boston, and New York City have all pledged to make drastic budget cuts or disband their police forces altogether. Are the calls as radical as they seem? And what protections would remain for law-abiding citizens? I've got Joe DeGeneva, former U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, with his thoughts. In my second block, Lila Gilbert, FRC Senior Fellow for International Religious Freedom, reminds us that Black Lives Matter not only in the United States, but in nations like Nigeria, too. Their atrocious acts of violence against Black men, women, and children surge while the international media turns a blind eye to the attacks by Boko Haram and other terrorist groups. She'll give us some perspective. In my third block, school is wrapping up for most American students, including my own, but officials in New Jersey felt it was the right time to adopt new standards for sex education in their public schools. The standards push homosexuality, gender identity, abortion, and sexual behaviors of all kinds. Behind the standards, none other than abortion giant Planned Parenthood. Kathy Ruse, Senior Fellow for Legal Studies and Director of the Center for Human Dignity, will join me. And in my last segment, the National Health Service in England has updated its policy on puberty blockers by removing the claim that the experimental drugs prescribed to transgender-identifying youth are fully reversible. In a fit of honesty, it now says it's unknown what the short and long-term effects will be on a person's bones, physical body, and mental health. And while tens of thousands gather in protest of racism and police brutality, churches nationwide are still subject to draconian COVID regulations on how many congregants can attend or whether they can attend at all. Abigail Schreier, writer at the Wall Street Journal and author of Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters, will join me to discuss. A reminder, TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. Go there for associated resources on today's program. Follow us on social media at FRCDC on Twitter, at T Perkins for Tony Perkins, and at Sarah P. Perry if you'd care to. Also, make sure you have downloaded the most recent Stand Firm app. It's available in the Apple and Google stores. Make sure you've downloaded the most recent version as well. We've rebuilt it from the ground up, and you can take Washington Watch with you now wherever you go.
What it would look like is you would have increases in vigilantism, and you would have increasing chaos in the city. And that's why doing things that prevent us from having a strong, effective police force are counterproductive. You'll end up having more killings. And that's been shown time and time again.
Well, that was a clip of Attorney General William Barr in an interview with Bette Baier of Fox News addressing the dangerous and irrational increasing cries for slashing budgets of police departments or dismantling them altogether. To replace them with what? With a presumably new and fundamentally different system of public safety. But how far does the demand go? If public pressure leads to defunding the police, would crime subsequently increase? And if you listen to the program yesterday, we talked about how many on the left are jumping on the defunding bandwagon. Defund the police is not a call from the fringes of the far left anymore. It's gone from a radical slogan to actual policy in a major American city within days. Joining me now to talk about it is former U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Joe DeGeneva. Joe, welcome back.
Delighted to be with you.
Okay, I have so many things I want to discuss with this new approach toward managing your own social justice and your white privilege and your criminal inclinations. Here's where we are. This seems to be sort of the rhythm of the news being a crisis, followed by a provocation, followed by an overreaction. And here we are in overreaction phase. So Cities like Minneapolis, do they, let's start with this, have the actual legal ability to eliminate whole departments altogether?
Well, that's a question of state law in Minnesota and city law in Minneapolis. And they can, as a matter of law, eliminate any government agency that they created. And if they want to abolish their police department, they can do so. But if they do that and they do not replace it with an institution that has the power and the force and the lawful authority to stop illegal activity, such as looting, rioting, arson, then the insurance rates in the city of Minneapolis will be either one, so high that no one can afford them, or two, insurance companies will not offer insurance in Minneapolis. So this is an experiment in communism. And I underscore, this is communism. What you are watching is a radical leftist agenda, which is anarchic in its origins. The American electorate has chosen a group of people at the local level, mostly funded by political campaigns funded by George Soros, which has at its core the destruction of the fundamental fabric of American society and displacing it with a radical version of America. This is, and I'm sad to say, I've said this for more than a year and a half, we are in a civil war, and it is a civil war for the fundamental rights of the American people and the Constitution. People are going to have to stand up. They're going to have to express their views that they will not tolerate this. And most importantly, they are going to have to vote.
Yes. Oh, we cannot stress that enough. And I will say this. I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second. I like to do that to give other people who may be listening in without the same perspective an opportunity to speak without actually speaking. In this case, I've seen plenty of very brightly colored and easily repeatable memes showing that this is simply a reallocation of funds. It's a moving of resources into social programs, welfare, housing. The thought being, if you elevate the populace itself, you won't actually have as many criminal incidents. What do you say about that?
Well, that's ludicrous. We have spent trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars since the Great Society program of Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s. And to what end? If you look at Chicago, 18 people murdered last weekend, 85 people shot last weekend. Now, and those are black on black crimes. And the Great Society was directed at improving the lot of the black population. African Americans are very smart. They know that these programs have been a massive failure. The notion that we're going to shift some funds from the police department and increase spending on social programs is ridiculous.
Yes.
You couldn't spend more on social programs than we're spending right now. But one thing is certain. This is a serious movement, seriously funded by leftist anarchist political operatives like George Soros, and it is clear they feel that they have the upper hand, and it is a very this is an inflection point in American history where we decide whether or not we are going to maintain the rule of law as we have known it since the founding of our republic, or we are not.
2 points here about Minneapolis I think need to be taken away by the listeners here. The actual crime rate after Jacob Frey took over as mayor of Minneapolis, he had a soft on crime approach from the outset. Carjackings were up 45%, homicides 60%, arson 58%, just from January through May 30th alone from the last period, this same time last year. But he said, listen, you know, the union's playing an outsized role here. We understand Chauvin was problematic, but I'm up against a virtually impossible wall here. I can't jump it. I'm dealing with cops who are unionized, contract and arbitration prevent me from getting rid of these bad cops. So is the problem really with the unions?
Well, I don't think I don't think there's any doubt that unions are part of the problem. I mean, if you look at this as a public administrator, my background is in law enforcement, naturally, and the law, but I am a political scientist by education. And one of the things that I studied was public administration, how you run cities and states and the federal government. The worst thing that ever happened to this country was the institution of labor unions for public employees. It shifted a huge amount of power to basically a few people who have the power to shut down government at any time they want to. Police unions generally are much better than that. They're pretty good. They rarely strike. They do what they have to do. But they do cause a problem in getting rid of bad cops. And that is something that the unions have to face. They have to decide that they have to be part of solving this problem. Otherwise, they are going to, in fact, be eliminated. I have no doubt that the left-wing governments in California, New York, New Jersey are going to make every effort they can. And the irony of this is that in destroying these departments by defunding them, and make no mistake, the transfer of money from a police department to a social program is defunding, whether they like to describe it that way or not. The fact is that when you do that, the sure net result of that is going to be more crime in black neighborhoods, less protection for law-abiding citizens in black and minority neighborhoods. This is insanity. But that's exactly what the people like Antifa want. They want civil discord. They want the society to fall apart because they believe, according to their own doctrine, that that's how they move in and take power.
Listen, it's not hard to predict the future here. Just a few days ago, an owner of a manufacturing company, Seven Sigma Inc., it's been in Minneapolis for 30 years. He's now moving his factory after law enforcement could not protect the plant from burning to the ground during the riots. So I anticipate you're going to see a mass exodus from these urban centers that are defunding or dismantling the police, which means your tax base has just dropped, which means you automatically can't fund whatever you have left in terms of law enforcement. I mean, really what they're doing is they are perpetuating their own problem.
Well, this is what happens when you have anarchic behavior. When anarchists decide they're going to take the upper hand, when police departments are literally handcuffed by people like Jacob Frey, this juvenile mayor of Minneapolis, and a crazy governor who is an embarrassment to watch on television. He looks like a grade school teacher giving a lecture to children in explaining these public decisions. And he couldn't wait to turn it over to Keith Ellison to get this horrible thing off his back. It's an inflection point, no doubt about it.
Absolutely. Joe DeGeneva, former U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, always great to have on, so knowledgeable about this. Listen, we need to follow the statistics, follow the money here, and we know where there is a police presence, crime is lower. Coming up, we're going to talk about the value of black lives amid rising violence in Nigeria, where the media has turned a bit of a blind eye. FRC Senior Fellow for International Religious Freedom, Leila Gilbert, will join me right after this on Washington Watch.
As coronavirus restrictions begin to ease, many Americans are grappling with how to adapt to the changing times. The last few months have transformed how worshipers think about church and how they are fed spiritually. While many churches are conducting services through live streams, drive-in services, and other means, questions still remain. What practical steps can we take? Are current restrictions appropriate? Do these restrictions violate the Constitution or religious freedom protections? Family Research Council has a new publication discussing religious liberty issues and offering practical guidelines for how churches and houses of worship can begin to operate as our country opens back up. Visit frc.org/churchguidelines to view this resource and learn more. As always, visit frc.org/church for our full list of resources for churches in the time of coronavirus.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Stay informed with what's going on in our nation's capital. Make a difference in your community and keep your friends and family up to date with Family Research Council's new and improved Stand Firm mobile app. Like never before, this new tool is bringing Christians across America together in advancing faith, family, and freedom. On the Stand Firm app, you can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the new Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes on our media player while conveniently going about your day. And you can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on our main feed so you can stay up to date on local and national news. Download the Stand Firm app on your mobile browser by visiting frc.org/app. That's frc.org/app.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. It is Tuesday, June 9th, 2020. I am your host today, Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony Perkins. The Stand Firm app, download it if you don't already have it. Carry the program with you wherever you go. You can find us also on any one of your podcast platforms or at TonyPerkins.com. Well, Black Lives Matter, and the world's attention is drawn to American racism and the tragic death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police, as it ought. But Black Lives Matter just as much in nations like Nigeria, where rising violence perpetrated by Boko Haram and jihadist Fulani herdsmen is leading to the death and maiming of countless Black men, women, and children. Joining me now is FRC Senior Fellow for International Religious Freedom, Lila Gilbert. Lila, welcome back.
Hello, Sarah. It's good to be back. Thank you.
So Nigeria, we know, after the USURF report for 2020, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, Nigeria was listed as a country of particular concern. But here lately, and according to what you've been writing about so repeatedly and fastidiously, it looks like the incidents in Nigeria are increasing with alarming speed. Is that an accurate representation of what's going on there?
Absolutely correct. It's accelerated to the point that it's actually hard to keep up with it. And the only way to keep up with it is through Christian outlets, mostly. There was one CNN one, but it's so hard to believe that people are getting slaughtered every day in the most brutal ways. And really, most of the world knows nothing about this.
And I don't understand why there is a particular turning of a blind eye to this. And I don't know if part of this is the result of the fact that so many of those who suffer at the hand of these militant activists are Christians. In fact, in your most recent article, Genocide Watch has stated that from June 2015 to February 2020, we're looking at almost 12,000 Christians losing their lives. That's a stunning number. So why the ignorance of the Western media?
It's always been difficult to get the attention of the West in terms of Africa. And you recall Rwanda, we grieved in the rearview mirror. And I think the same here in Nigeria. But yes, it's also, you know, that everyone walks on tiptoes about radical Islam, and nobody wants to call it out. And we're looking at radical Islam at work here. And that's what this is about, at least in large part. There may be tribal variations or other issues, but primarily we have Allahu Akbar shouted when these people are slaughtered and brutally killed.
Now, it seems also that there is sort of a switching of the balance between jihadist Fulani herdsmen who weren't actually taking place in the majority of these killings and maimings, and Boko Haram, which traditionally has performed most of these horrific acts. But it almost seems as though the tide has shifted a little bit. If that's the case, what accounts for that, do you think?
Well, part of it's geographical. I think Boko Haram attacks in one area of the state of Nigeria, and the Fulanis are in a different area. But we also have to remember that the government of Nigeria, the president, Buhari, who has been called out directly to his face by President Trump about this Christian abuse, is a Fulani. He's a member of the Fulani tribe. Mm. Now, the whole Fulani tribe isn't radicalized. I mean, it's a huge tribe over five countries or something.
Sure.
But what's happening in Nigeria in the name of that tribe connects to the government. And everybody you talk to about this from Nigeria, and I'm on WhatsApp with a bunch of people, and they all believe that this government is actually turning a blind eye at best.
Is the sense among the continent of Africa also one of ignorance? Is it sort of not paying the sufficient attention to what's going on and what has, it sounds like, amounted to genocide in this country? Is it within the continent itself? Is there an interest in what's transpiring or a desire to actually intervene and do something productive with government resources?
Well, in the surrounding countries, yes, I think there's great alarm because they, too, are under threat by the same group and also by ISIS or ISWAP. I get a little confused by the acronyms, but we're talking about the Islamic State, and they are moving through that general area. So, yes, there's certainly concern there in terms of other places like Kenya or Uganda, where they have other threats from al-Shabaab and other groups. Probably they've got their eyes on their own troubles. But certainly in West Africa, where this is happening, there is serious concern, and the French government's getting involved, and Americans may still be around. I don't know how many we've pulled out and how many are still there. But, yes, it's a concern. It's more than just Nigeria, in other words. But Nigeria is a huge economic center for all of Africa. It's the leading country in Africa. So it's also important, not just because of bloodshed, but because of what it represents in the entire continent.
Absolutely. Well, we were all paying attention to what was transpiring when Boko Haram kidnapped en masse the 276 girls that were the face of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign back in 2014 in April. And yet since then, it seems as though it's been very difficult to bring the world's attention to this. Do you think that it's going to take international involvement? It's going to take particular action on the part specifically of the president to be able to effectuate any kind of meaningful change there?
I think it will. I think it could at very least involve some sanctions on those that are responsible for this. And I think there's movement toward that, but it's very, very hard to get the big machinery of the West moving. And even if people are well-intentioned, it's really difficult. But what Christians can do is pray, and that's not a small thing. And that's what I keep saying. Let's just pray and push as hard as we can otherwise.
We know that the prayers of the righteous availeth much, and we will pray with you, Leila. Leila Gilbert, who is our Senior Fellow for International Religious Freedom. Coming up next, we'll talk about New Jersey's State Board of Education adopting extreme Planned Parenthood sex ed curriculum with FRC's Senior Fellow for Legal Studies, Kathy Roos, on Washington Watch. We'll be right back.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Stay informed with what's going on in our nation's capital. Make a difference in your community and keep your friends and family up to date with Family Research Council's new and improved Stand Firm mobile app. Like never before, this new tool is bringing Christians across America together in advancing faith, family, and freedom. On the Stand Firm app, you can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the new Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes on our media player while conveniently going about your day. And you can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on our main feed so you can stay up to date on local and national news. Download the Stand Firm app on your mobile browser by visiting frc.org/app. That's frc.org/app.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry sitting in with you this Tuesday afternoon. Welcome. Make sure you have the Stand Firm app. Go to TonyPerkins.com for more information. And you're going to want more information on this segment if you have kids in school, like I do, as does my next guest. According to a recent National Assessment of Educational Progress report, now this is known as the Nation's Report Card, only 25% of American eighth graders have a basic understanding of history or geography. But that hasn't prevented New Jersey's State Board of Education from devoting time and resources to the adoption of a radical sex ed curriculum sponsored by none other than Planned Parenthood. Joining me now is FRC Senior Fellow for Legal Studies and Director of the Center for Human Dignity, Kathy Roos. Kathy, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
So just when I think we've hit a new low in the mission to sexualize Americans' children, we hit a new low. So talk to me a little bit about this particular curriculum up in New Jersey.
Well, sadly, this is just yet the latest example of the transformation of sex ed into something far beyond education to really cultural transformation and activism. We've got powerful groups like Planned Parenthood, Southern Poverty Law Center, Human Rights Campaign, these very rich, powerful international organizations all getting into the sex ed business because sex ed isn't really about sex ed anymore. It's about creating a new generation of sexual ideologues that will toe the party line, really. And we see New Jersey now mandating that all schools comport with this curriculum that includes things like lessons on advocating for community policies to promote transgender identity.
Oh.
That's what sex ed's about in New Jersey now.
Fabulous.
It's awful. Yeah. So it's really gone so far beyond the imparting of information to really creating activists, sexual ideologues.
Your average 13 or 14-year-old cannot tell you about the Boston Tea Party and its significance to the Revolutionary War, but boy, they will know how to paint a trans-identifying pro poster and stick it on a wall in a public school, which absolutely infuriates me as the mother of three children. But talk to me about comprehensive sex education generally. You've been studying this, following it for years, yeah. writing on it. I'd like to say, okay, again, devil's advocate, as I told Joe in the first segment, we find a correlation with curriculum like this and lower rates of pregnancy or lower rates of STDs. Is that actually the case?
Well, it's absolutely not the case. In fact, tragically, in the teenage population, sexually transmitted infections are just going up, 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 and up. And you would think that the more hours of sex ed that the comprehensive sex ed proponents are pushing on these kids, that it should be producing some results. But it's not. Mm-hmm. It's really, and of course, people with common sense would understand that, of course, the opposite is going to happen.
Right.
You're going to see higher sexual experiences on the part of kids.
Right. Absolutely. Now, this is a Planned Parenthood program. This is a curriculum of theirs. Are we to assume that there are other schools in the United States that will just gobble up a preformed curricula like this and use it to plug and play in their own classrooms?
Apparently, if we take Planned Parenthood at its word, schools are. They claim to be the largest provider of sex education in the country. But it's not only Planned Parenthood. It's these other organizations that we've already discussed. All of these big groups are getting in on the sex ed game. They're mailing their programs to public schools across the country. Human Rights Campaign is so rich. The SPLC is so rich.
Oh, yes.
They've got programs called Welcoming Schools, Teaching Tolerance. They all have a program. They're pushing it on public schools. And many public schools are administrators are quite willing to accept and implement them. We see the SPLC's Teaching Tolerance, they have best practices guide where they have mailed to every principal in the nation a slick program on how to have a trans-inclusive prom and how to create a queer school culture in their public schools. Can you imagine the amount of money it takes to mail a slick program to every principal in the country? That's
well, it makes sense.
And they've got the money, and they're doing it.
It makes sense if you've got $500 million in assets to your name. Again, I don't know why poverty remains in the actual title of the SPLC, and yet it does. I tell you what really bothered me the most about this, not just the graphic nature of the curriculum, but the fact that one of the goals is to, quote, analyze the influence of peers, family, media, social norms, and culture on the expression of gender, social sexual orientation, and identity. And what I hear in this as a mother is, how is your parent influencing you? What are they teaching you at home? That God has made you male and female, and he does not make mistakes, and that gender is not a spectrum, but with very few medical exceptions, we are created with the gender of one particular identity, male and female. I think that bothered me the most, as it really is, as so much of this is, a way to subvert parental authority.
No question about it. That is the goal. They want parents out of the way.
Because that, of course, makes it so much easier to get the kids to swallow whole cloth all the propaganda they're getting. Speaking of propaganda, England's National Health Service has removed trans guidance, claiming that puberty blockers are fully reversible because they, through a Tavistock gender clinic, were sued. We'll talk to Abigail Schreier, writer at the Wall Street Journal and author of the upcoming book, Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters, right after this on Washington Watch.
As coronavirus restrictions begin to ease, many Americans are grappling with how to adapt to the changing times. The last few months have transformed how worshipers think about church and how they are fed spiritually. While many churches are conducting services through live streams, drive-in services, and other means, questions still remain. What practical steps can we take? Are current restrictions appropriate? Do these restrictions violate the Constitution or religious freedom protections? Family Research Council has a new publication discussing religious liberty issues and offering practical guidelines for how churches and houses of worship can begin to operate as our country opens back up. Visit frc.org/churchguidelines to view this resource and learn more. As always, visit frc.org/church for our full list of resources for churches in the time of coronavirus.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Stay informed with what's going on in our nation's capital. Make a difference in your community and keep your friends and family up to date with Family Research Council's new and improved Stand Firm mobile app. Like never before, this new tool is bringing Christians across America together in advancing faith, family, and freedom. On the Stand Firm app, you can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the new Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes on our media player while conveniently going about your day. And you can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on our main feed so you can stay up to date on local and national news. Download the Stand Firm app on your mobile browser by visiting frc.org/app. That's frc.org/app.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry. Well, so much to talk about in this segment. Two different topics I want to discuss with my next guest. Let's start first with the National Health Center service in England. They have updated their policy on puberty blockers by removing the claim that the experimental drugs prescribed to trans-identifying youth are, quote, fully reversible. Now, in a fit of honesty, it has to say that it's unknown what the short and long-term effects are on a person. And also, while tens of thousands gather in protest of racism and police brutality, churches nationwide are still subject to draconian COVID regulations on whether or not they can meet, and if so, how many. With me today is Abigail Schreier. She is a writer at the Wall Street Journal and the author of the upcoming Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters. Abigail, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Okay, so the NHS in England revised guidance on synthetic hormones for children experiencing gender dysphoria, but only after the Tavistock Clinic was sued. Tavistock, for those of you who don't know, the only gender clinic in England. Do you think this is what it's going to need to take until we get to this point of common sense strictly on these drugs in America?
I think so. We now have eight bills in America in which they're trying to make puberty blockers illegal. And they've had to do this because scientists aren't engaging in honesty. I mean, look, mm-hmm. I'm a journalist. I'm not an activist. My job is not to stop people from using puberty blockers on their children. My job is to tell the truth. And on this issue, not enough people are telling the truth. And the truth is, as Tavistock has now come clean about, we have no idea what the long-term effects of these drugs will be.
And from the outset, it seems that there has been sort of a rush to medicalization of these kids. And my thought is that this sort of comports with what we were seeing in the societal trend, that as soon as transgenderism became sort of this wave in the media and there was increasing visibility and there were calls for medicalization of children, there was an increased use of these particular hormones puberty blockers without really knowing what the long-term effects were, which it's heartbreaking. As a mother, I think if my daughter, my teenage daughter, were subjected to long-term medication use without a physician giving me full disclosure of what the risks were, I would be devastated and, quite frankly, picking up the phone to call my lawyer.
That's right. We're going to see a lot of lawsuits. And the reason there is that doctors are being activists rather than being doctors. So, you know, I've interviewed a lot of doctors on this topic, and they'll tell you that when they go to conferences, you know, whenever it's, you know, a new heart medicine or any other kind of medicine, there's an open discussion of risks and benefits, because all medications have risks and benefits. But when it comes to transgender medicine, and the one researcher I interviewed, she said it was like an infomercial for trans. Mm. In other words, no discussion of risks were ever assessed. And the problem is puberty blockers are a profound intervention, okay? They shut down the part of the puberty, that's the pituitary, that stimulates puberty, so that an 8, 9, 10-year-old will not go through the normal puberty. The sexual organs will remain the size and capacity of a small child. They will not have the potential for orgasm, and they may lose permanent fertility. You know, they may be permanently infertile. Profound interventions, not to mention that hormones shower the brain. So what we're doing is really an experiment that we don't know the long-term effects of, and patients aren't being advised of that.
Yes. And I'm also particularly concerned, like you mentioned, with the effects on mental health. You flood the brain with these cross-sex hormones for a child who maybe has an undiagnosed underlying mental health condition like depression, bipolar disorder, even high-functioning autism, which I know is the case sometimes for girls who present this way. One can only wonder what that kind of medical intervention does. So to that extent, I applaud the NHS for doing what it was legally responsible in doing, which is saying, okay, we can't say that it's fully reversible and there are no side effects. But I'm disheartened because there are so many gender clinics in the United States, and you're looking at a rash of lawsuits before the medical community writ large all comes together and says, okay, we need to do some actual scientific research on this. I don't think any of that exists.
Right. So in the past decade, we've gone from 2 gender clinics in the United States to well over 50. Some people say it's 65, and maybe. But Planned Parenthood now is one of the biggest dispersers of cross-sex hormones, testosterone. So as you mentioned, so first they put a small child on puberty blockers to block puberty, and then they, after a couple years, they put them on, as you mentioned, cross-sex hormones. Any child who goes from puberty blockers to cross-sex hormones will be permanently infertile. And the problem, as you mentioned, is we actually have no idea what the long-term risks are. And as I talk about my book, and we have reason to believe that they are extremely severe and irreversible.
So I am of a mind, even though this hasn't been discussed much, that there is a very close nexus between prescribing these medications and the involvement of the pharmaceutical industry as a whole, because naturally both the doctors and the pharmaceutical companies stand to profit from increased use of these drugs. Obviously, I am not someone who has an issue generally with big pharma, but I can't help but think that there is a contributing role here.
Well, yeah, they are very pricey drugs. There's no question. They're very pricey drugs. And the Affordable Care Act, one of the things that it did was it made these drugs, you know, in some cases free for young people, and even the surgeries, very de minimis cost. So all of a sudden, these were really available. You could get these fancy surgeries, and it costs you almost nothing. You know, you're, unsurprisingly, you're seeing a lot greater demand for it.
I want to switch topics a little bit, and I want to talk about sort of the relationship between what we're seeing in the streets here and what we're seeing behind church doors. Apparently, as someone once said to me recently, COVID is no longer a thing, because we are seeing throngs of people in the streets protesting, tens of thousands. In fact, the footage from Los Angeles is particularly jarring because it is an entire boulevard, down Sunset Boulevard, packed with individuals, absolutely shoulder to shoulder. And yet, so many houses of worship, whether they're churches or synagogues, they are all subject to these increasing, continuing regulations. We're all having to follow these phased reopenings, and it's 25% capacity or only 50% capacity. Talk a little bit about the double standard here, because I have to believe the media knows they're not being honest.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, my synagogue in Los Angeles has been closed now for 3 months. This is in a country founded on, you know, guaranteeing free exercise of religion to its inhabitants. We've been closed now for 3 months. Now that the new regulations allow us to reopen if we guarantee to only 25% capacity, there are no similar restrictions on other businesses, retail or other businesses. And the Supreme Court so far has allowed that. They, you know, there was a Supreme Court order that allowed that. This is a disgrace, and it's one that the clergy really shouldn't have gone along with so completely. That doesn't mean that the clergy should not have practiced any kind of social distancing. I wasn't saying that, you know, that they should have defied orders, but they certainly should have, you know, offered more protest and more questions about, wait a second, why are the managers of Trader Joe's trusted to keep social distancing and we're not? Something more important is on the line. And no one seemed to, you know, certainly none of these state and local governors seemed to recognize, you know, state and local executives seem to recognize that there are many parts of the First Amendment, and you know, the very first right in the First Amendment is free exercise.
You know, I actually found it very compelling. You made in your recent Wall Street Journal op-ed, you made the argument really that a lot of these religious leaders did not protest loudly enough, if at all. And I have to tell you, I'm guilty, because when this came out, when we were hearing word of a pandemic, as somebody who's immune compromised and has a child who's immune compromised, I immediately thought, oh, you know, we got to bar the doors. So I understood. Our church was extremely responsive in getting everything online. I go to a church with, you know, all the high tech bells and whistles. But I look now in retrospect and I think, I wonder if we just jumped too quickly. And now that we see the double standard in the media between what we're seeing in New York and Los Angeles and what we're seeing in Dallas and Minneapolis, and there are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of individuals in the streets, I'm not compelled by an answer like that of Mayor Bill de Blasio when he said, you know, this, we're protesting something that has a 400-year history of the United States, and kind of all bets were off. Was his approach. And I'm thinking, okay, well, we also have a constitution that's been around for a couple hundred years. So at what point does one outweigh the other? I mean, you hate to minimize it down to that level of calculus, but it really is ridiculous that he can say that with a straight face.
That's exactly right. I mean, look, we all did it. We shut down our synagogues, our houses of worship, because the last thing we wanted was to put lives in danger. All right.
Right.
But the problem came when we naively assumed that the state and local executives will be honest and allow us to reopen. I mean, they wanted to extend this as long as possible because, frankly, they were more interested in their pet issues, and they considered, you know, religious observance really a hobby that sort of we could do without.
Right.
They made no bones about it. They were quite honest. They were shutting down outdoor Jewish funerals in New York.
Right.
I mean, you know, people who responded to my Wall Street Journal column, they said, well, you could have just had synagogue outside. Funny, we weren't allowed to do that in Los Angeles. We were specifically prohibited. We, you know, in New York, they broke up funerals.
Yes.
They, you know, there was no reason for it. And I suspect they knew it.
Yes.
Certainly the local leaders knew it.
Absolutely. Well, and again, this is sort of a function of where we're going, where the tide is taking us right now, that you and I and organizations like this one are swimming against right now, and we will continue to do it. I'm going to give a link to those who are listening. FRC.org/coronavirus is a link of where we're keeping tabs on what states have pending legal action, what the regulations are in your state. We have an ongoing blog series where we've been tracking victories and defeats for the case of religious liberty and the ability of houses of worship to stay open or to continue to remain closed. But Abigail, I have to agree with you. I do believe that this has to go to whatever the pet issue is. And these are all democratically controlled areas as well. I need to also reiterate that again, not to hammer on the Democrats, but the fact remains that these are the ones in which you are seeing the greatest number of protests and concurrently the greatest number of lockdown regulations, which to me indicates all you need to know about where the priorities specifically lie. And it's certainly not with constitutional fidelity.
I mean, the people who really disgrace themselves worst of all, I think, are the public health officials. And it's a shame because we're going to need them for the next for this pandemic and the next one. And instead of being, you know, men and women of science, they revealed themselves to be, you know, really little more than sort of, you know, college sociology professors or, you know, critical theory professors who decide that this protest was more important, you know, was a health issue. The fact that they were willing to lie and say that really showed their hand. And unfortunately, it means that we really can't trust them the next time. And it's too bad because we need public health officials that we can trust.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I know that your new book doesn't drop until June 30th, and I don't want to spoil all of the good stuff in it because I have read it. It is tremendous. If readers want to get a copy in their hands before June 30th, how can they get a copy of your book?
So go on Amazon or, you know, wherever books are sold, and Irreversible Damage is the title, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters.
Was this a quick write for you, or was it a laborious one? Because the evidence is so plentiful. I would imagine this just flew off the computer screen.
You know what? I'll tell you the truth. This is not an issue that's personal to me. You know, I didn't have any personal experience with it. A reader wrote to me, and I just, because of that, I just went out and I talked to everybody. I talked to transgender adults. I talked to trans-identified teens. I talked to doctors, endocrinologists, you know, public school teachers who push gender ideology. And I just wanted to hear sort of what and figure out what they had to say and what was really going on. And I hope I presented that as fairly as possible. And it really was a labor of love. I put my heart into this book.
Well, I am in high praise of this book, and we encourage our readers to go get it on Amazon. It is an essential book for this day and age and really shed some light on some characteristics, some trends, some data that are not being brought to the light by any mainstream media outlets. Going back to your op-ed just as we close out here, I really appreciated what you said about an America riven by politics surrendering some of its tribal hate and recovering its bonds of affection. And there is no other place, particularly in this day and age, when we are talking about separations over identity politics and in particular race, than a house of worship. That's where we go. That is where we find our center. That is more essential now than it has ever been, if I'm to be honest. And I appreciate the right of redress and the right to protest and the right to raise one's voice. But more so, I appreciate what is fundamental to who I am as a person, and that is my faith in God and my ability to express it.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, people are pushing these protests so hard. And look, protest is a very important American constitutional right. But I think it's very clear that politics are not going to bring us together. But religion actually might. Worship might. And if you're closing down the churches, you don't give people a chance to come together. You don't give a chance for repentance. You know, the murder of George Floyd might not have happened if those, you know, police officers had been in church, you know, the Sunday before, and the rioting might not have happened too.
Abigail Schreier's been my guest. Oh, so much good stuff to talk about. We're going to have her on again to talk about her new book available on Amazon. I must say it's been a pleasure being with you all today. I'm going to be back tomorrow on Wednesday's edition of Washington Watch. Until then, make sure you have the Stand Firm app, and we'll see you tomorrow on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com.
Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.